This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bussin. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss more about your health span with naturopath Dr. Colleen Hartwick. We'll learn the difference between sex aids and sex crutches with sex therapist Serena Haynes. We'll find out about the digital assessment of cognition with Dr. Henry Monka, PhD. And lastly, we'll discover how to do no willpower workouts with personal trainer and author PJ Glassy. Before we get to that, here's your tonic quick shot. Scientists have found a new way to help reduce fat in the body by using plant-based microbeads. In a recent study, rats that ate high-fat diets and were given the microbeads passed similar amounts of fat through their intestines as rats treated with a weight loss drug called orlistat. However, the microbeads did not cause the stomach problems often linked to the drug. The research team, led by Professor Wu and Associate Professor Yung-Cheng He from Sichuan University, is now working with a biotechnology company to produce the microbeads on a larger scale. According to Professor He, all the ingredients in the microbeads are food grade, already approved by the FDA, and easy to produce in large amounts. To move their research forward, the team has started a human clinical trial with West China Hospital. So far, 26 people have joined the study. Professor Wu says that they hope to have early results within the next year. If successful, this could be an important step toward a safer, more natural way to help people manage their weight without the side effects of current weight loss drugs. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: the Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. I'll be joined by Dr. Colleen Hartwick in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal, organic or wild-crafted. These oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including Argan, Rosehip, or Skin Lover's Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores. Last month on this very show, we did an interview with Dr. Colleen Hartwick about health span. And it is such an expansive and important topic. Guess what? We didn't get through it all. And there's lots more to talk about. And so I thought it would be fun to bring Colleen back and pick up from where we left off. How you doing, Colleen?
I'm doing really well. Glad to be back so that we could do our best in the time given to finish off this conversation.
Right. So where we left off, we covered food intake and we talked about resistance training as two key aspects of being healthy as you get older. And I want to pick up from where we left off. And for those who didn't hear the show, go to the website and listen to it as a podcast and you'll be fully up to speed. Let's pick up from where we left off. Other than resistance training, are there other types of movements that you advocate for which would help somebody as they get older?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, resistance training is probably top tier if you're limited on time and, you know, had to choose what would be the most impactful. But aside from that, something as simple as walking can dramatically improve blood sugar regulation. It really helps with reducing stress, that sort of forward movement with a visual cue moving in your periphery really helps to reduce stress. And I've often recommended, because lots of people enjoy walking. I live on Vancouver Island, so we've got some beautiful hiking trails. So walking is like, and hiking is just sort of second nature to a lot of us islanders. Something that I've recommended to patients to increase sort of the intensity of their walk is by a weighted vest. Or if you don't want to buy a weighted vest, add in a little extra resistance. You can take a backpack and just like put in some soup cans to add some weight there. And what that does is keep pushing your cardiovascular fitness. And we know more cardiovascular fitness improves cognitive health, blood sugar regulation, and in keeping with this conversation, improves health over the lifespan. So walking, as well as some sort of balance and stretching. Having a sense of balance is protective, not just in the short term, but in the long term. Helps to protect against the tendency for older individuals to sustain a fall and potentially sustain a fracture. So that could be self-directed stretching or something like a yin or a restorative yoga class, which can be really helpful for maintaining the fluidity of the joints.
I'm going to add my two cents worth. So walking, if you want to make sure you're going to walk, get yourself a dog, because then you don't have an excuse and you have a companion to go on the walk with you. Whatever the weather, they're game for a walk. So you should be too. That's point number one. And point number two, to your point of stretching. So I'm of a certain age where I'll work out and I think everything's fine. And then the next day I've got this pain that didn't exist. And what I've done is I've actually doubled the amount of stretching that I do each workout. So I now have a good 30 to 35 minutes of stretching every single workout just to make sure I'm keeping limber and making sure I've got the ability to do the movements that I'm doing with the weights that I use.
I love that. Number one, I'm a dog owner, and this dog, it could be raining sideways as it does often on Vancouver Island in the winter when it's storm season. He could care less about the weather.
Yeah.
And we're out rain or shine, so it helps to just build in that consistency. And yeah, stretching. I think so many people forget that like muscles have two main qualities, contraction, so shortening, which is what we do when we're doing strength-based exercises. But muscles are also elastic and want to like stretch, but we often neglect that stretching bit. And I remember as a former competitive athlete, not stretching a lot as a kid, and I could get away with it. But now that I'm in my 40s, I can't anymore. And like you, I'm like an obligate stretcher, because if I don't stretch, I notice it immediately in my low back where I have a pre-existing injury. So at this point, yeah, stretching is a non-negotiable because I don't want to have back pain.
Yeah. And for those who think, you know, it's a maybe or a not, like I have a partially torn Achilles. So I used to be a runner, cannot run anymore. If I don't do the proper stretches for my lower legs, there are some days I can't even walk. So it's super important to keep on top of it. Let's shift gears. Let's talk about gut health and how it impacts our overall health.
I mean, yeah, great question. This area of study has really, to use, again, puns as I like to do, has really blossomed. I remember first learning about gut health 20 years ago when I was in university. It was the first time I heard probiotics, did a presentation on it. Our gut plays a huge role in overall health, from metabolic health and insulin sensitivity to mood to about 70% of our immune system is derived by gut bacteria. Those bacteria can play a huge role in cognitive health by producing that important BDNF that I mentioned in our last episode, as well as modulating chronic inflammation. So really focusing on gut health, I think, is a key pillar to overall health and wellness. Especially as we get older, digestion tends to become more sluggish. We can see decreases in gut motility, decreases in gastric secretions like stomach acid, which makes older individuals much more vulnerable to changes in their gut microbiome. And those changes are typically not favorable changes.
Okay, so you touched upon it with your last answer. Let's discuss cognitive decline. Is there anything that we can do to get in front of it as we get older?
Absolutely. So many different things to consider incorporating if you're not doing it already to help support cognitive health. And like we mentioned in the last episode, irrespective of your age, where you're starting from, better late than never. And there's no time like the present to get started. So if you're in your 50s, 60s or 70s and feel like you're too old to start implementing these things, I would challenge you on that and say, there's always things to be done, and there's the possibility of regaining some of what's been lost if you're in the latter parts of your life. So number one would be exercise. Again, working muscles make that important BDNF, which helps create new neural connections and attacks our existing neurons from damage. Damaged neurons don't regenerate, they die. So that BDNF helps to protect our neurons from damage so that they don't die. Maintaining a healthy gut microbiome by doing things like eating lots of fruits and vegetables and fiber. Gut bacteria can produce what are called short-chain fatty acids, which then work indirectly to increase BDNF in the brain. As well, making sure you sleep enough. We do so much housekeeping of the brain in deep sleep. This is stage three of sleep. But if you're not getting enough sleep cycles, which is usually 5 to 6 sleep cycles a night, which equates to somewhere between 7 to 9 hours, depending on how long your individual sleep cycles are, or you're not getting into deep sleep to begin with because maybe you're imbibing in some alcohol before bed, or cannabis can interfere with deep sleep. Some other medications can do that as well. You don't get that same brain housekeeping. And what can end up happening is we could think of our brain and our nerve cells like a highway system, and that debris accumulates during the day. If you're not sleeping, the cleanup crew doesn't make it in there. And what that can do is interfere with neural firing, which can then show up as forgetfulness and confusion as the days go on. Of course, working on your diet and trying to, again, limit those ultra processed foods that can breed inflammation and oxidative stress is of crucial importance for cognitive health. In addition to physical exercise, mental exercise is also really important. So doing puzzles, word games, especially if done socially. Humans are social primates, and engaging with people helps reduce stress. And we know people who have chronic stress actually have areas of the brain that play a vital role in cognition and memory. Those areas of the brain shrink under the influence of the stress hormones like cortisol, so the hippocampus and the prefrontal cortex. So staying connected, having community, engaging in, say, playful puzzles, mental games, Scrabble with a neighbor or friend, I would consider incorporating all of those.
Does bragging about how quickly you do crossword puzzles or finishing, you know, the Times puzzles online, does that count as sort of the social aspect of puzzle doing?
I would say yes, as a bragger to myself.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, because I have like a stellar connections record, which I will share with anybody who asks, and sometimes with people who don't. I actually do crossword puzzles, Sudokus, and various other puzzles every single day to keep sharp, and I actually think it's crucially important.
I love that. I remember in university and in naturopathic college, we would get the Toronto Star that has a really good crossword in it. Yep. And I, like you, I love crosswords. I have since a kid. I love all puzzles, jigsaw puzzles, give me a puzzle. And I would just do, before my first lecture, the crossword as quickly as possible. And what was interesting to notice over the course of my time in university and college is like more and more classmates started to do it. And not to say that I had any direct influence over that. It was just neat to observe that like nerdy me was just like quietly doing my puzzles. And then over time, the class seemed to take on that habit as well. And I always took pride when I was
You're not a nerd anymore. You know, Gen Z is all into crossword puzzles. Did you know that?
I did not. Apparently I was born in the wrong generation.
Yep. You and me both. So we touched upon sleep, and you used the word several times in our discussion, and it seems to be overarching. And I think we should maybe spend a minute on it. And that's inflammation. And why it's such a key player in aging.
Yeah. So there's this sort of new term. It's a portmanteau, which I love because I won't call myself a nerd, but I like words. It's called inflammaging. So where chronic inflammation accelerates the aging process. And we could get really technical, but that's probably going to be a little bit boring. But chronic inflammation essentially damages cells and accelerates the aging process. So one of the things I find myself talking to patients about over and over again is that inflammation plays a role in all sorts of chronic health conditions, including the aging process. And I like to visualize inflammation like a fire.
Yep.
Right. And there's actually aspects that overlap with a fire: heat, redness, swelling, right? It's a decent analogy. And that fire has we could take a two-pronged approach to the fire. We've got the fire starters. I call those the arsonists. So they're what's igniting inflammation. Right. So this is diet, ultra processed foods. This is stress. This is exposure to environmental toxins, to pharmaceuticals, for example. Right. We want to address the fire starters. Right. What's igniting the fire. But then we also want to incorporate some firefighters. These are the things that help to tamp down on that fire. These are things like herbs and spices like ginger and turmeric and black pepper are omega-3s, quercetin. Taking a sort of a two-pronged approach to addressing inflammation can really help increase the health span and decrease the likelihood of developing any chronic health conditions.
We talked about the physical body and we've talked about the brain, but let's talk about emotional support as we get older. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, so important. So because COVID wasn't that long ago, I remember what it was like for me. And I'm a bit on the introverted side. Like I quite enjoy my time alone, mm-hmm. but being restricted from engaging with people on the day to day, I found myself after about 3 weeks without physical interactions with people, having thoughts of like, I want to hug a stranger, which really highlighted to me that even though I'm more on the introverted side and tend to recharge in my own company, that even us introverts have this biologic drive for connection. Again, I mentioned that humans are social primates. We're supposed to be in community, right? With our family, our friends, our loved ones. It really helps to buffer stress. And you think about it evolutionarily, if you're alone against the whole world and all of the predators, your level of stress is going to be really high. So having friends, having a support network, people you can have fun with is so important for overall health and again for increasing the number of years spent vital and in good health.
If somebody is just turning their minds to sort of their health span, what would you recommend that they do first? What are first steps?
For increasing your health span, I guess it would really depend on where you're starting from. And I know we've talked over the last couple of episodes of a lot of things from supplements to diet, to exercise, to sleep, to community, to reducing inflammation. And that might feel really overwhelming. Like, oh my God, there's so many things I need to change. So what I generally recommend is, you know, pick from the list of what 7 things we've talked about and do that, right? Keep it simple and frictionless. And because too much change can be overwhelming. So I guess if I was to pick sort of my top 2 things, I would recommend prioritizing. This is in part based on what I'm seeing with patients in terms of what their core issues are, is making sure you get enough sleep, 7 to 9 hours, and get some movement in.
Good advice. One more question to go. And that is, what's one message you want listeners to carry away from our discussions about health span?
Yeah. So if you're really wanting to increase the number of years you spend in good health, that's a culmination of your day-to-day choices. So what you do now, what you do tomorrow is going to influence what your future self experiences in terms of overall health and longevity.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure.
That was Dr. Colleen Hartwick. We have to take a short break, but we'll be right back on The Tonic. For more than 30 years, Genestra brands have been trusted by health professionals across Canada. Their supplements are supported by scientific research and manufactured to meet high-quality standards. By combining traditional use with modern clinical evidence, Genestra provides professional-grade supplements that support your health. Learn more about their full range of products at genestra.ca. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Serena Haynes is a certified sexologist, sex and intimacy coach, somatic sex educator, and studied clinical sexology. She has a background in psychology and has studied relational counseling. She also studied relationship counseling through the Gottman Institute. Serena is here to help guide you forward on your journey to sexual expansion, whether that is physical, such as erectile challenges, difficulty with orgasms, or your intimacy with yourself or your partner or partners. For more information about Serena, visit serenahaines.com. Welcome back, my friend. How you doing?
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. Yeah, I'm doing great.
So we're going to talk about the concept of sexual aids and whether or not they're necessarily a good thing. In other words, whether something which may be perceived as an aid actually becomes a crutch. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I get this a lot because, you know, people come in with all kinds of stigmas and taboos around the things that they really love. And I like the idea of talking about the aid versus a crutch, because I think that's it's going to help a lot of people understand where their pleasures come from rather than having to feel bad about them.
So, you know, I guess we've already sort of said so implicitly. There is a difference between something that is serving you as an aid and something that is that becomes a crutch, right?
Right, exactly. So pretty much anything, you know, considered an aid or a crutch, if I'm being completely honest with you. The way that we distinguish that usually in clinic, but, you know, talking to other people, is if something is benefiting you and it's adding to your experience, but you don't rely on it, then it can be an aid. It can be lovely. But something that becomes, you know, a crutch, we all know what that means, is that we rely on that. And for whatever reason, and however that shows up for us, we have an unhealthy relationship with it, either with it or the relationship with this crutch causes an unhealthy manifestation in your life somehow.
Okay. Here's one that I think people have used as a sexual aid for a long time. And of course, I don't mean it in the context of, you know, getting somebody drunk so that you can have sex with them. We're not talking about non-consensual sex. We're talking about consensual sex. Do you think that alcohol is an aid, though, or is it an aid that can become a crutch if it's relied upon?
Right. So I think you said it. It's an aid that can become a crutch. It could also be a crutch. I mean, in and of itself, it really just depends. But any alcohol is that it's going to lower your inhibitions. Right. So once we lower our inhibitions, what we kind of talk about in my world is releasing the brake a little bit. There are a few things in our lives that, you know, maybe it's a stigma or a taboo. Maybe it's just the stress of a day. Maybe it's something. Now, if we have one glass of red wine with dinner and we happen to feel like the day melt away, you know, quote, the day just melts away, and you're able to kind of take your foot off the brake for a little while and let yourself settle into a different mindset, then that could be a really great aid for you if it's something that just kind of happens. But if you're relying on that to in the mood, to feel arousal, to do things that maybe you wouldn't normally do and then feel bad about it, you know, those are the spaces that we want to make sure we're not using it as a crutch. The thing with alcohol is that although it limits our, like it decreases our inhibitions, which sounds decent, it sounds like a good thing sometimes, it also decreases arousal and sensitivity and all of those things. So you could be using it for one reason and all of a sudden you're actually getting the opposite effect.
Okay, so we there's a lot to unpack there. And I think we can unpack that through what I would describe also as a potential aid. And it's more meaningful to my life experience, and that would be recreational drugs. I'm not much of a drinker, but I enjoy cannabis from time to time. Mm-hmm. For me, I'm a person who lives inside their heads. I have a constant narrative that goes on, and it isn't necessarily a good one. And I find that if I'm taking recreational cannabis, that voice gets tuned out. Which for me is crucial. And it isn't about doing things that I wouldn't do normally. It's more about being present, if that makes sense.
Right. Yeah. No. And so in that case for you, Jamie, right, it would be an aid. And then you can also sit back and say, you know, maybe in my everyday life, I don't rely on it all the time. I just know that this is where I feel the most quiet in my head. The thing with recreational drugs, cannabis is one of them, and generally it does kind of quiet the voices and it can increase sensitivity for a lot of people. So that's a really good thing. Personally, like if we're going to share our personal stories, cannabis for me just zones me out. Like I'm not present at all. So we all know what works for us and what doesn't. Then there's other drugs like, you know, MDMA, you know, the Molly, ecstasy, those kind of things. Again, they're stimulants. So they're going to increase your sensitivities. They're going to increase your ability to even be present and aware. And people who don't participate in those kind of drugs don't recognize that so much as a positive thing. But there's a lot of studies being done with microdosing MDMA for, you know, PTSD and all kinds of things. Well, we don't get into that now. It's not necessarily sexual, but just the idea that it can increase your awareness and your presence as well. So as long as you know what is working for you and what is not, it can definitely be an aid. If you find, I find a lot of the time, when it comes to cannabis specifically, I'll have people come in and say, I take the cannabis. It feels really great. I'm with my partner. I have orgasms. I do all of the things, but I can't without it. So in those moments, there's going to be some of us with our heads and things that are going on that maybe it is something that it's like it's a medication and we're going to need it to kind of settle our brains. There's some of us that don't need it to settle our brains, but we do it out of habit. And then that habit creates a negative impact on our sober participation with a partner. In that space, I would ask somebody to maybe just recognize the practice that we can do without the recreational drug in order to help us do something sober with our partners, especially if it's becoming, because if you come to me and ask me that, then it's obviously something that's bothering you in your life. So if something bothers you in your life, then I tend to sit back and say, okay, how can we address that and move and shift things around a little bit.
Okay. Let's assume theoretically that for an individual, cannabis, for example, increases sensitivity.
Yeah.
Is that necessarily a bad thing? Even if that's true and there, and so why would that be a bad thing if they continue to use it?
No.
In support of sexual encounters. It's not, is it?
Yeah, I don't think, no, it's not. But here's this, the distinction lies in, does it cause you any pain, like heartache, pain, challenges when you don't use it? Okay. So, and I don't necessarily mean physical. You can say to yourself, okay, if I use the cannabis, I have the best sexual encounters. Fantastic. When I don't use the cannabis, I don't have the best sexual encounters. But you know what? I'm okay with that. The problem comes when you say, I can't, don't use it. I don't have good sexual encounters. And that bothers me. That's the distinction that we want to make. So if you're having a great time using your cannabis, fantastic. If, you know, when you don't use it, you know, maybe it's a little below par. Well, guess what? Not all of our sexual encounters are going to be, you know, 100% all the time. We chalk it up to maybe not a great day. And then we move on. But if it causes you distress that you can't have a good sexual encounter without your cannabis, that's where we want to work on. Does that make sense?
It does. But I suppose it depends on the individual, right? Because
some people
are more self-aware than others. Like, you know, somebody may do better with cannabis, but then not really care that that's the case, you know, like, and I don't know. I suppose it depends on how their partner feels.
Well, and this is it. It depends on a whole bunch of things that are coming in. Honestly, it's such a general way of putting it, I know, but the word is distress. If anything or anybody has been caused or is causing distress in some way, if mentally you're having like a back and forth on it, if with your partner you're having challenges and discussions, maybe arguments, that becomes distress, right? And then that distress is what we want. And just say, okay, well, we don't have to change anything, but let's have conversations about it. You know, maybe we bring a partner in and we say, you know, just because they're using the cannabis doesn't mean that they're trying to zone out from you, because that's what a lot of people would think. They're actually trying to be more present because it settles, like you said, it settles the voices in my head and it settles me down so that I can be more present with somebody. You know, so then we just have those back and forth conversations, because not everybody's point of view and perspective is going to be the same.
Okay. So I want to talk about a different type of drug because I think your answer may be different. Let's talk about performance enhancing drugs like Viagra, Cialis, or for women, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, Adderall or Vyleesi. What are your thoughts on those?
So performance enhancing drugs are meant to help you physiologically. And that's the bottom line. And, you know, physiologically for Viagra, let's say, let's just go with the male penis enhancing drug right now. So it's meant to help you, you know, with blood flow and actually get an erection and, you know, be able to participate in the things that you're doing. If you don't have a problem with that, but you're taking it because mentally you think it's going to help you go faster, stronger, you know, longer, that can become distressful, because then when you stop using it, you're going to go back to what we call baseline performance levels, but they're not going to feel as good for you, right? You're not going to feel even mentally maybe as masculine, or, you know, that you can go longer, or that your penis feels hard and strong and, you know, all of those things. So once you go back to that baseline, now, if you actually have a challenge with your erection and you use it, fantastic. Do it forever and ever and ever. That's no big deal. That's what it's meant for. It's not going to increase necessarily your desire. So this is where the female enhancing drug comes into play, which is a little, I have a couple of different ways of looking at that, because a lot of the time, you know, if we exist as women, what comes right before our arousal is desire. And none of these drugs are actually going to increase your desire to want to have sex. They really just increase your arousal levels and the blood flow and the things like that. But if you still don't want to mentally, it's not going to help you at all. So I think that Viagra is a fantastic thing, and all of these things are great to use if you're having trouble physiologically with your body. But if you use them when you actually need them, if you go back to a baseline level, you may find yourself feeling a little less than in certain ways, which can cause distress.
Okay, let's switch gears a bit. Time for one last question, and I'm going to lump two together that maybe you wouldn't. Pornography and sex aids, literal sex aids and toys. Any different perspective than the others that we were talking about in terms of them being an aid or a crutch?
Honestly, you know, Jamie, it's such a hard, I know everybody wants a really specific answer on this, but I think all, like, porn is great. I think that if you find yourself not being able to perform without them and it bothers you, that's the problem. Now, that's mostly with sex toys. Pornography can have a little bit of a different effect on our brains because it's more of a mental component where a lot of people who use a lot of pornography are having, you know, they're able to participate without having the intimacy involved. There's no rejection involved. There's no, you know, performance anxiety involved. None of those things. So then when you're with a real person, if you haven't practiced without the aid of pornography, then your imagination has gone down a little bit. You get more in your head. So, you know, that's a longer discussion to have. But as long as it doesn't cause you distress, as long as it's not causing distress in your partnership or within any other facet of your life, then it's always considered just kind of the cherry on top. And that's the way I'd like people to think about your sex toys. Sex aids when it comes to disability or,
it's different.
Yeah. Unable to do things, different.
Totally makes sense. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
That was Serena Haynes. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss the digital assessment of cognition on The Tonic. Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal, organic or wild-crafted. These oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety, including argan, rosehip, or Skin Lover's Blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores. Convincing yourself it's just another unflattering haircut? Going for a swim and getting a sunburn on your scalp? Miss having bedhead? Ditch the drama and get your hair back so you can stop worrying and start feeling like yourself again. Contact the experts from Form Face and Body. Call 416-447-6176 or visit formfacebody.ca. Stop worrying and start living.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Bussin.
Dr. Henry Monka is a leading expert in the field of cognitive neuroscience and the CEO of Brain HQ, a groundbreaking brain training program. With over two decades in experience in the field, Dr. Monka has dedicated his career to understanding and enhancing human brain function. Welcome back to the show, Henry. How are you?
I'm doing great today. It's a pleasure to be with you, Jamie.
So we're going to talk about something very specific today, and I'm going to need your help with it, and that is acetylcholine. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
You're doing it perfect, Jamie. Well done.
What is it, and what is its role in cognition?
So acetylcholine is a kind of neurochemical that's in your brain. And it's actually incredibly important for brain health and for cognitive function and learning and memory as well. So what acetylcholine does is it sends a signal to your brain that, hey, what's happening is important and you might want to learn and remember it. So every time you're paying attention to something, like you're paying attention to me right now, Jamie, and I'm paying attention to you, our brains are actually pumping this neurochemical acetylcholine. And what that's letting our brain do is realizing, hey, this is important and I might want to remember it tomorrow and the next day. So it's a signal to the brain that it's time to be ready to change and reorganize and learn. And as you might imagine, that's a pretty important part of brain health. If you have a healthy brain, it's because your brain can change and remember and learn. And acetylcholine is a crucial part of that. So having good acetylcholine function is important for brain health. And hey, if you don't have good acetylcholine function, probably don't have a very healthy brain.
Why is acetylcholine such a strong candidate as a biomarker? Is it that it's for cognitive decline? Is it because it's traceable, or is there something specific about it, or why focus on that?
There's just been tons of evidence really over the past 30 or 40 years now that when your brain starts to lose this important neurochemical, acetylcholine, that's as your cognitive function and your brain health start to decline. So let's look at Alzheimer's disease, for example. You know, when we first started to realize that Alzheimer's disease was, you know, not the natural part of aging, but sort of a disease process in aging, one of the first things that researchers figured out is that, hey, one of the early signs of Alzheimer's disease is your brain stops producing as much acetylcholine. And that's probably why your brain health is declining. And that's probably why people who have Alzheimer's disease start to have memory and other thinking problems. And in fact, that discovery was so important that the first drugs to help with Alzheimer's disease, you might know of a drug called Aricept, for example. That's a pretty common drug that's prescribed for people who have early stage Alzheimer's disease. Those first drugs actually helped acetylcholine work better in the brain. So the fact that those drugs were at least a little bit effective tells us how important acetylcholine is, because by helping acetylcholine work better, hey, that was one of the first treatments for Alzheimer's. And so we know that acetylcholine is incredibly important in the aging process and incredibly important as people start to show those first signs of Alzheimer's. But the question has always been, well, how can we measure it, right? We don't really want to poke a needle into your brain and see how much acetylcholine is there. Right. And we don't really have other mechanisms like that. But it's such a helpful thing to know more about. That's what raised our interest in this study. Can we figure out how well this neurochemical is doing in your brain without, you know, drilling a hole in your head and putting a needle in there and having a look?
How far in advance do the acetylcholine levels drop before you start seeing the symptoms of something like dementia or Alzheimer's? Is there a gap, or is it pretty much a lockstep?
Well, you know, acetylcholine starts to decline pretty early on. And in that sense, it's almost certainly a leading indicator. Okay. It's something that is a change that's happening before the thinking and cognitive changes start to happen in Alzheimer's disease. You know, most doctors at this point recognize that Alzheimer's disease is an incredibly long process, right? We might think of it as, hey, mom was fine, and then one day she had Alzheimer's disease. But when we look back, we recognize, hey, there were a lot of changes that were happening before she got that diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. And most clinicians would now say, hey, there's a process that's starting 5, 10, even maybe 20 years before that diagnosis, where the brain is starting to become more unhealthy. And it's only when that process has gone on for quite a number of years that someone's thinking and memory is so impaired that we really notice and they get diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. So, you know, acetylcholine function changes a fair amount between, you know, when you're in your 20s and when you're in your 60s. And that early, just subtle decline probably presages kind of the cognitive decline that's associated with aging, and then eventually perhaps the transition to Alzheimer's disease. Now, once you get Alzheimer's disease, of course, that decline becomes much more swift. But that's why it's so interesting to think, hey, can we measure these declines before a person is diagnosed with Alzheimer's? Because if we have that sense that someone's acetylcholine is starting to decline, hey, maybe there are things we can do to help keep their brain healthy before they go on to Alzheimer's disease.
Okay, so not to bury the lead, but but you have a process by which you don't have to stick needles into people's brains in order to measure the acetylcholine levels, right?
That is exactly right. You know, as you mentioned, I work at BrainHQ, and we're basically a digital brain health company. And we ran this incredibly exciting study with a colleague of ours at McGill University, where for the first time, we were able to show the relationship between a digital brain health assessment, something you can do on your phone or on your computer. We were able to show the relationship between that test, which doesn't require putting a needle in your head, and actually how much acetylcholine a person has in their brain. So to do that, we had to use this advanced brain imaging technique, which is really almost only available at McGill University, sort of an incredible center for this kind of work. And by using that advanced brain imaging technique, we could see how much acetylcholine people had in their brain. We could measure how well they did on this brain health assessment and show that those things were deeply related. And that's what's incredibly exciting.
Okay, so I'm imagining that like people put sensors on their heads and then you get kind of like an MRI image, or how does it work?
Yeah, it's kind of like that. It's called a positron emission tomography image, a PET image. Okay. And the way that it works is they actually, it is quite a serious procedure, which is, you know, why they don't just do it if you go to your doctor. You know, it's really part of a research study. You sign an informed consent document and they put you inside a brain imaging scanner. And they actually then inject you with a molecule that binds to the cells in your brain that produce acetylcholine. And when that molecule binds to those cells, we can measure how much of that molecule is binding. And that tells us how strong or perhaps weak your own acetylcholine function is. So we can do that, but it's very expensive. And you can only do it a couple times a year because of how the technology works. And, you know, it's just never going to be available like in your doctor's office, right? You're never going to go in and get a PET scan in your doctor's office for just sort of a check-in like this. But we can do it in the context of this research study. And what that tells us is across this group of people we measured, for each person, we knew exactly how much acetylcholine they had in their brain. Some people had a lot and some people had a little. And then we could also measure them with this digital brain health assessment and see what the relationship there was.
So people aren't required to go to Montreal to get this test then, right? They can do it from home?
Well, to get the PET scan, you have to go to Montreal and be in a research study.
Right.
But as a result of this new science where we show that, hey, we can do, you know, reasonably well with just the digital brain health assessment, this is now something that anyone can do at home or that a doctor can give you, and it doesn't require all this kind of fancy technology. Now, a trip to Montreal is very nice.
It is.
But it's very, very nice to be able to do this in your own home as well. Yeah. And so by establishing that linkage between the easy at-home assessment that you can do or your doctor can ask you to do and the gold standard of measurement of acetylcholine, that PET scan in Montreal, we now kind of validate that this in-home measure can be used to give doctors and people a sense of how their brain health is doing, and in particular, how this important neurochemical acetylcholine is doing.
So what do you see the impact of this new tool going forward? Like, it's pretty fresh now, right? So where's this going?
Hot off the presses. Well, the world we want to see is a world where people can start to monitor their brain health and their doctors can help them monitor their brain health. You know, think about going to see your primary care provider, right? One of the first things that you sit down when you see your primary care provider, even if you're just there for a regular check-in, or maybe you just have a, you know, kind of a minor health complaint, is, hey, they always take your blood pressure, right?
Yep.
You can't really go to a doctor's office without getting your blood pressure taken. And as a result, you get this incredible historical record of your blood pressure. And then if that changes at some point, you know, that tells a doctor, hey, maybe something's going on with this person's heart. Now, we want to have brain health taken as seriously as heart health. We want to see a world where people and their doctors are checking in on brain health in a regular way so that if something changes, and who knows why it might change, but the first thing to do is notice if there's a change in brain health, hey, then you and your doctor can figure out what's going on and do something about it. Now, if we want brain health check-ins to be as easy and as normal and as straightforward as heart health check-ins, well, we need a pretty easy measure of brain health. And so what this study shows us is this digital measure of brain health, this very simple computerized brain health assessment that only takes about 3 minutes to do, hey, is a pretty good measure of brain health. If people were to do that once or twice a year, the same way they get their blood pressure measured with their doctor once or twice a year, we'd all start to have that kind of history of how our brain is doing. And then if something happened to us, right, we start to experience some cognitive decline, but maybe something else, right? Maybe we have a fall off our bike and get a whack on the head, or maybe we have some other kind of medical treatment that affects our brain health. We would be able to see with this easy digital assessment that, hey, this person's brain health, this measure of acetylcholine in the brain, hey, has changed. He or she is not doing that well, and a doctor or you should look into it. So that's the world we want to see, where people are taking brain health as seriously and measuring and doing something about their brain health as they are about their heart health. And that's because brain health is so incredibly important. Alzheimer's is increasingly prevalent. Other brain health issues like Parkinson's or other kinds of dementias are prevalent. And we all worry as we get older that our brain health is going to start to decline. And hey, maybe we're not going to notice, so to speak, until it's too late. So by making this easy digital health test available, help people keep track of their brain health and help people do something about their brain health.
Well, let's focus on the do something about it. So I understand that there may be some brain exercises that you could do to upregulate acetylcholine. Where are we at with that? Has that been proven, or are we just looking into that theory?
That's exactly the right question to ask. You know, if we're going to know something about brain health and we're going to know something about acetylcholine in particular, hey, what can we do about brain health and acetylcholine?
Yeah.
And so with brain health in general, hey, there's lots of things people can do, right? You know, we know that physical exercise is helpful for brain health. We know that eating a healthy diet is helpful for brain health, and getting good sleep is healthy for brain health. And of course, one of the most important things a person can do for brain health is, you know, exercise their brain or train their brain. And as you mentioned, of course, that's one of the things we're doing here at Brain HQ, is building these science-based brain training exercises that improve brain health. And you're absolutely right. When we did this study at McGill, we didn't just measure people once and figure out that there was a relationship between their acetylcholine and this brain health assessment. The next phase of that work was to take half those people and have them do brain training exercises for Brain HQ, and take the other half and have them play ordinary video games and ask the question, does Brain HQ training affect brain health and acetylcholine levels? And here I have to leave us all in suspense, because the scientists are still finishing their analysis on that front. But the early signs are looking positive, and it would be pretty exciting to find out that not only can you measure your brain health with a simple digital assessment, or your doctor can help you do it, but hey, there's something you can do with brain training to improve your brain health and improve your acetylcholine levels. Because hey, every piece of the science we know tells us that if you can improve brain health and improve acetylcholine, well, you're going to have a happier, healthier brain that lets you live a better life, and you might even be more resistant to the onset of Alzheimer's and dementia. And that would really be a pretty exciting piece of news if the analysis goes forward in that way.
It would. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Would you come back and let us know where the study goes?
I would be delighted. Again, we are doing the math as we speak, and there should be something to say about it, I hope, soon. And I'm delighted to have this great collaboration with a Canadian neuroscientist here.
That was Dr. Henry Imonka. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss the no willpower workout on The Tonic. For over 40 years, the Big Carrot has been the community's go-to for fresh, local, and organic goodness. As a worker-owned natural food market, the Big Carrot is all about healthy living, sustainability, and bringing people together. They've got everything you need, from vibrant produce and bulk goodies to natural body care and wellness advice to keep you feeling amazing. And their kitchen and juice bars, serving up deliciousness every single day. Now, as they celebrate 41 incredible years, they're inviting everyone to join the fun. Head to thebigcarrot.ca to discover more, and follow them on Instagram at The Big Carrot for a chance to win big in their anniversary giveaways.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of The Tonic newsletter, Jamie Busson.
PJ Glassie started personal training in 1987 and grew his business successfully for the following 11 years, training clients out of their homes and local gyms. With these clients' help as test subjects and armed with his degree in exercise science, PJ invented his multi-protocol concept and refined it through 1998 when he founded the X Gym. He's also the author of the book Cracking Your Calorie Code and the inventor of his brain type test, which helps people achieve health and fitness results much faster through specific brain wiring techniques tailored to their unique brain type. Welcome to the show, sir. How are you?
Thanks. I'm doing great. Great to be here.
So I found the whole concept of choosing to do workouts based on your brain type really an interesting concept. I came from being a person who really didn't work out at all to somebody who got very fit in his late 30s, basically doing exercise on his own. And then I think you know the drill. When you exercise over a number of years, you kind of need to change it up every now and then. Although I tend to be a creature of habit. Pre-COVID, I took a lot of classes and in fact started to begin to teach those classes. And then post-COVID, during COVID, we put a home gym in. And since then, really, I haven't been to a group class. So I've kind of done it all, but that's not right for everybody, right?
Exactly. Everybody's different and we all have different personalities and different kind of brain wiring and preferences and all that.
So you developed a brain type test to help people achieve health and fitness results. Can you explain a little bit about how brain types impact health and wellness?
Yes. It really depends on how your brain is wired and what makes sense to you. So typically, traditional personal trainers are going to give their clients specific advice on nutrition and exercise and motivation and all that stuff. They're going to give this advice based on what works for them as the trainer personally, because they've found that over time with their own experiments and trials and errors and what have you. And so they automatically assume that the way that they've found to get fit is going to make sense for their clients. And 20% of the time it does, but 80% of the time the client comes back with frustrations.
Yep.
They feel like, oh gosh, you know, that sounded like great advice and it's worked for you. So obviously you've proven it, but for some reason I'm struggling. And then the trainer replies with something like, well, just suck it up, have more willpower, and just gut through it, and it'll work for you. What the trainer doesn't realize is they're not speaking the language of the brain type of their client. They don't even know about brain types. So they just assume it's going to work for everybody, and it doesn't. And it works out with lots of frustrations and speed bumps and walls that they run into and all sorts of things. And I was coming across this myself, and I had already developed about 30 different brain training techniques that help people rewire their brain to think differently and to get past hurdles or food cravings or what have you that's getting in their way of the results. But I would have kind of a guess of what brain training technique might work for a certain person, but it was like throwing spaghetti up against the wall. So I just decided, hey, I need to figure out how to get a shortcut to find the brain training techniques that are going to work for this particular person. And that's when I decided to develop my brain type test. And the test, it's a 20 question quiz, and it gives people which of the 16 brain types they are. Most people get two types, a primary, secondary. Some people just get one type. And then it gives them a whole bunch of advice catered to their brain type and their brain wiring. So the advice is going to make sense to them. And the brain training techniques are much more likely to be effective for them.
So it isn't so much that it's a no willpower workout. It's rather, it's more attuned to the way that you're going to process doing something that perhaps you normally wouldn't want to do.
Bingo.
So for example, I have a partially torn Achilles. I used to run. I can't run anymore, but I row. And I row kind of like through HIIT training, but I also used to row more like 5K or 10K rows, which now as I get older, I dread them. I do it once a week. And and for me, that is like getting over the hurdle. For me, once I decide I'm going to work out, I do it. But it's getting to that point where I don't make the excuses to do it. So for example, for me, the tipping point is when I put on my workout stuff. If I put it on, I know I'm going to do the workout. But until I don the shorts and t-shirt, it's really a 50-50 proposition if I'm going to work out that day. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. What you're describing is one of my techniques. It's called the trigger technique. And it's when you make something a little bit easier to do by putting a trigger in front of you. Like, for instance, if you want to start running, you would put your shoes out in the open where you're going to almost trip over them.
Yeah.
You have to notice that they're there. And then, oh, that's a trigger. I use this all the time for food prep.
Yeah.
So next tomorrow, I'm going to have this bigger deal food prep thing that I'm going to do. I'm working on a new recipe or whatever it is. So what I'm going to do the night before is I'm going to put out three of tools that I'm going to need, kitchen tools, and I'm going to put out two ingredients that I'm going to need, or maybe all the ingredients, and I'm going to stick them on the counter. So then the next day, I'm going to look at that, and A, I'm going to remember, and B, I'm going to think, oh, I'm already a step ahead, so this makes it really easy.
Yeah.
And it's a trigger. So that's what you're describing. And that's a very effective technique for a lot of the brain types.
So I actually took your test as a little bit of an exercise to see if it resonated. And it turns out I am a revolutionary first and a craftsman second. And, you know, some of the stuff was really true. Like, for example, you described the revolutionary as somebody who has a quick to anger trigger and is skeptical about new things and won't do new things unless it sort of makes total sense to them. But once it does, they are sort of in whole hog, which describes me to a T. So it is interesting. So I'm curious, what are you and how does it impact your workouts?
Well, my primary is the scientist, and then my secondary is the inventor. And both of those brain types are pretty extreme introverted. So the primary brain type and the secondary brain type, well, the primary is who you are at home.
Yeah.
That's who you are with your family. And then secondary is who you are at work. Now, sometimes they're flip-flopped, either because the person didn't understand the instructions when they took the test or whatever. But it doesn't really matter, because if the person says, hey, it's really my secondary that resonates the most with me, then I don't tell them, well, you were thinking about work when you took it. I just say, great, let's just go with that, because you know that we'll make that your primary. And then let's go with the advice on there. And so, you know, it gives a lot of different things. You talked about personality types, stuff like that, part of it, which is important. And then there's also the best workout part and the top two or three hacks part.
Yeah.
And the one that I skip to first for people is page 3 of the PDF that has clickable links to the brain training techniques. And then if they have two types, which, you know, 90% of the people do have two types, then I look at those techniques. There's half a dozen of them, and I see if there's some repeats between the two brain types. And for you, the EFT technique is a repeat and the word swap is a repeat. So those are the two that I would tell the person to, you know, really get on and learn those first and master those, because these are techniques that get better and more effective with practice. So the more you do them, the more effective they get at rewiring your brain to think differently and act differently and form new habits easily and avoid things like food cravings or whatever struggle that you're dealing with that's getting in the way of your results.
Right. Because part and parcel of who I am is I'm an emotional eater. So for me, you know, I'll eat healthy. You know, I have oatmeal for breakfast virtually every morning. You know, we cook most of the food we eat, so it tends to be healthier and not hyper-processed. But the witching hour for me is when my family's asleep and I'm alone late at night and my mind starts racing and I'll start eating. And that obviously impacts my health and wellness. Like, I'm fit, but I've always historically carried extra weight. And that's just the way it is. So this is particularly interesting for me. It's sort of an overview of your health, which includes not only fitness, but food, sleep, mood, etc.
Yeah. And what you're describing is the EFT technique. And that would be a superpower hack for you to learn that technique and get really good at that technique. And there's on the PDF, there's a clickable link to, you know, to do it. But for people that are listening here, just as a skip before you take the test, if you do ever even take the test, go to tapping.com. That's not my site, but it's a good one that describes the technique really well. He uses different tapping points than I do, but mostly the same. And it's still effective because, you know, it doesn't really matter. It's just all about breaking your pattern. And so for you, it would be doing the EFT technique around hunger or emotional eating or whatever resonates the most with you. So you would... One of the repeats on your test is word swap. And that technique is thinking about a certain word. So you're going to label whatever is making you hungry. It's probably going to be an emotion because you already said that. So then you label it, you give it a word, and then you swap it with something that's less intense.
Okay.
Less intense of a word. So now you're transforming that emotion by changing the label of it. That could be enough. But if it's not, stick with that label and then do the EFT technique using that label as the word that you're using for the EFT technique. And that'll make more sense once you do the tapping. But then you're combining those two repeat brain training exercises to get rid of that habit at night.
Super interesting. Thank you so much for coming on the show to explain that.
Oh, my pleasure.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Dr. Colleen Hartwick, Serena Haynes, Dr. Henry Monka, and PJ Glassie. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contests, prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you know you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.